Okay, so I'll do the Namo Tassa to begin with, as I usually do on these occasions. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Very good. So this particular sutta, and it is a sutta, it's in the Sutta Nipata, was suggested to me by somebody, and I was going to teach this 2 weeks ago, and I had it all ready, all prepared, and then what happened? Lockdown. So I couldn't so teach it that weekend, so waiting for this weekend. And this is the first, again, as I said, sutta which I've taught, you know, for quite a while because of the COVID, that we stopped the sutta class. But at the same time, because Ajahn Bhumali was teaching from the suttas in the Eightfold Path. So I thought that was supplying enough inspiration and knowledge about the words of the Buddha in the suttas. So I haven't done one for quite a while now. And this one, which was suggested, is a very simple sutta, and many of you have heard this. In fact, all of you have heard this when we do our auspicious chanting. It's one of the core suttas in what we call the Paritta chant, in Sinhala, the Pirit. And it's chanted in all the Theravada Buddhist traditions, whether you go to Sri Lanka or Burma, or Thailand, or Cambodia. They all chant the same sutta, and another couple of suttas as well, which is common to every tradition. And one of the reasons we do that chanting is not just as a ritual, it's also because the meaning is really important, and sometimes can be quite inspiring when you understand what it means. And it's important that, especially the monks, who do this chanting also understand its meaning, because quite frankly, that gives the chant much more power. When the monk gets inspired when they do the chant, it adds much more intensity to whatever we're conveying to those people who are listening, which is one of the reasons why some of these chants are amazing and very, very, very powerful. And it's one of the reasons why we very rarely do this chanting these days, because it's very long. But one of Ajahn Chah's favorite chants was on the dependent origination. And often he would ask the monks, actually he'd ask the monks to chant it when he was being sick, but also during his time when he had a stroke, the monks would usually come and pay respects to him and chant that for him once a week, because it was inspiring if you knew the meaning. So this is a chant called the Mahamangala Sutta. At first you may think, oh, it's just, you know, quite ordinary, but it has some very powerful meanings as well. And some of the Do you remember, of all the Deva stories which I've told you, which ones do you remember the most about heavenly beings? You can say something, come on. You don't remember anything. Ah, the can of Coke. Yeah, do you know that story? Okay, here it comes. Because sometimes that people, especially people who have grown up in a very skeptical, questioning Buddhist Western tradition, sometimes we're very doubtful about the existence of heavenly beings, or what you might call like supernatural beings. But on this occasion, I was, you know, walking through a part of Thailand in the northeast which hadn't been really developed yet. So it was there was no electricity around. The roads were all dirt roads. And for some of these places, I was the first white man villagers had seen, let alone being a monk. So in some of these regions, when I was walking, it was a long way, you know, between villages, and many kilometers. And also it was a dry season, so there wasn't much water available. So usually, if you're walking through these mountains and jungles, you go along the forest path, but you always have to take your own supply of water. And that day, it was so hot, I'd run out of water. And there was no water to be seen anywhere. And I was walking, and I was getting very thirsty. And I actually found out later on, that I did have an episode of, I don't know, it could have been heat stroke or just not enough water in my system, because I got very sort of wobbly on my feet. And what I usually do then is just sitting down and meditating for an hour under a nice tree. And I sort of was okay afterwards. But anyway, I came to a ridge in the mountain, and I saw in the valley, which is quite obvious, that's where the people put the villages, because there'd be little streams in there. It'd be a much better place to have the first habitations in an area which was being developed. So I saw there was a village of maybe 5 or 6 houses, and I knew from experience that one of those houses would be the general store. Just where they'd have things like important requisites of life in those days, like cigarettes, matches, Pepsi Cola, kerosene, and other little things of life. But especially, I know there was, I think it was Pepsi's, not Coca-Cola, but I don't remember which. Say it was a Pepsi. So in those days, in Pepsi Cola, you knew it was the water was clean. So it didn't need to be filtered or disinfected. And it had a bit of caffeine in it, probably quite a bit, I don't know, but it'd give you a big boost, and sugar as well when you weren't eating in the afternoon or evening. That really was very uplifting for you. So I knew there would be some Pepsis in that village. But I also knew that according to our rules, we cannot ask at all. I can't go up to someone and say, please give me a Pepsi Cola. That is not done in the monk's tradition. So what did I do? I started remembering the story of one of the great forest monks during the Second World War, who was in Burma. He was a Thai monk, but living in Burma, practicing there. And that when Thailand just gave in to the Japanese invaders, then Thais and Japan became allies. And in India and Burma at the time, it was run by the British. And the British, therefore, did not like the Thais. And even Thai monks, many British soldiers thought the Thai monks were spies. And so the villagers, the Burmese people, told this monk, you better get out of Burma quickly. So, and you can't go the main routes, because the main routes, all of the border crossings would be run by the British. And they would probably just take you away and just interrogate you and really maybe harm you, hurt you. So it's dangerous, so you can't go that way. The only way to go from Burma into Thailand would be through the jungles, through the mountain routes, for the paths which hardly anybody traveled. Otherwise, it'd be too dangerous. And to stay is dangerous. So this monk had no choice. He went through the jungles and up the mountains on these places where there were paths, but hardly any people using them. And even though you may think, oh, there's always somebody there or some path, I spent a range retreat in 1978 or 9 or so. In 1978 or 79, up there in the north of Thailand, very close to the Burmese border. And the mountains were really steep, and there was lots and lots of jungle there, and it was really remote. And even the time I was there was many areas where there's no villages at all. So he decided he had no choice but to go by the remote route. And walking on that route, it had been about 3, 4, 5 days. He hadn't seen any human being, no villagers, hadn't received anything to eat in 5 or 6 days. And those paths were very steep going up and steep going down. And he was getting exhausted. And then he had the thought, according to his biography, he had the thought, so I'm not going to make it. I'm going to die on the route. I don't know where the next village is. I'm not going to get any food for days, and I'm already really exhausted and tired. And then he remembered in some of the suttas, just like this one here, the devas, the heavenly beings, will be very interested in monks and ask for teaching from monks and nuns. And then also, they would help monks and nuns sometimes. So this monk made a resolution. This old forest monk said, I am a good monk. I keep my precepts. I meditate. I don't do anything wrong. If there are heavenly beings, it would be a wonderful thing to give me something to drink or eat. Otherwise, I might die. He made that resolution in the jungle. And about, I don't know exactly how long afterwards, but very shortly afterwards, quarter of an hour, half an hour, he turned a corner in the path and he saw, standing by the side of the path, a well-dressed gentleman. And that was one of the first strange things. The man was well-dressed. In his remote areas, in the jungles, people don't dress like that. They wear rags, just comfortable things, not just well-dressed. And the man had one of these tiffin cans, a series of metal basins, one after another, about 4 of them, in which people would carry food from place to place. And often, and I saw this many times, when they'd offer food to you, they'd have tiffin cans, and they put food from the tiffin can into your bowl. But of course, even though this man was weird what he was doing there, and why he had a tiffin can there. But anyway, the monk knew that he couldn't ask anything. So he went to walk past this strange man in the middle of the jungle. But even though he was walking past, he heard the man say, Nimon Krap. And if you have ever lived in Thailand, you know that that is the word meaning, I invite you, I want to give you something. And when it comes to Nimantana, the invitation, and Krap is the honorific, like, sir, please, I want to give you something, sir. So the monk stopped. And you're not supposed to look at the man's eyes. So the monk just opened his bowl. And the man opened up this tiffin can and put in some very fresh, clean, hot rice and some beautiful curries. And he said that this was not the sort of food which you have in the remote areas, which is usually potatoes or sometimes animal curries, you know, with monkey hand in it or something, because it's very poor in those areas. This was very good food, hot. And the monk started thinking, how on earth did this man know that I was coming? How did he get well dressed like this? Why is it such delicious food? What's he doing here? So the monk, he broke a little precept in those days. He looked at the donor and asked him, where have you come from? And according to the story told by this monk, he became a very famous monk afterwards. The man never replied. He just pointed. From up there. And that was the story of this monk being saved by a heavenly being. There's no other real explanation for that. But what's that got to do with my story? I thought, well, I'm a good monk. I keep my precepts. And I'm just walking. It's just a bit of bad luck. I didn't find any water. So I made a resolution. If there really are devas, and it comes a lot from the old idea of being a scientist, doing an experiment. I really was a good monk and I really needed some water or something. So I said, if there really are devas, if there are, can they get me a Pepsi Cola? And I really needed it. And so, with that resolution in my mind, I walked into the village. And as I walked into the village, I saw in the corner, I kept my eyes down, but I saw in the corner of my eye that there was the hardware store, the general store, and some people in it, but I never stopped. I was a good monk. I never spoke anything. I walked right past. And as soon as you walk past like that, you think, well, I'll survive. There's no devas in this world anyway, so who cares? But then I heard, after I was about 5 meters, 10 minutes past the shop, I heard someone say, Nimon Krap! And I turned around. I never said a word. There was a person running after me with an open bottle of Pepsi Cola with a straw in it. Cold, refreshing. And I thought, this is weird. And I sat down on a bench. And I thought, well, maybe just coincidence. People are kind. But then another person came running after me. Nimon Krap. With another bottle of Pepsi Cola. And another person came running up with a third bottle of Pepsi Cola. And for those of you who've ever been to Thailand, you know the magic number in Thailand, the one which they always think is the best number. And any one of you who any counts, any donations, sometimes that you may have like $1,800 for some big donation. And they'd always try and bump it up to $1,999. I've seen that many, many times. And somebody else, oh, just bump it up to 2,000. No! 1999 is more lucky number. So 9 is a lucky number in Thailand. It means actually the number in the Thai language means prosperity. Gao. Anyway, so I had 9, but of course, another person came up, and a fifth person, a sixth, a seventh, an eighth, a ninth person came up. And I sat down on this bench, and look, I get excited because I can remember this. I can almost visualize it now. But so many years ago, almost 42 years ago now. And I remember just lining up the 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola, looking at them. No way I could drink 9 bottles, no matter how thirsty you were, but it reminded me that somebody was trying to make a point. That things like heavenly beings do exist. And they do look after you if you really need something. And experiences like that, where it was a challenge, it was a sort of, you know, asking for some favors because you really needed it, and they came up with the goods. And of course, I just drank a little bit from each bottle. There were some kids playing around, so I gave the other Pepsi Colas to them. So anyway, they are heavenly beings. And in this occasion, the heavenly beings were just asking the Buddha to teach them something. Just like, you know, human beings would ask some good monks to give them a Dhamma talk. This time the heavenly beings were asking. And the heavenly being was asking in particular, you know, what is the, almost like you may say, what is the meaning of life? What are the greatest blessings, the most wonderful things you can do with your life? How can you live a very beautiful, wonderful, meaningful life? And so then the Buddha answered, and this was the Mahamangala Sutta. Mangala means like blessings, auspicious things. Any Burmese people here? Yeah. Oh, that's right. And how do you say like a greeting to someone? Mingalawa. And that comes from the Mangala. Mangala, I don't know what the awa means, but isn't that, you know, may you be auspicious, blessed, or whatever. So mangala has that meaning. And even in Thai, whenever we do the chanting, they call it to chant mongkon. Mongkon is the Thai way of saying mangala. And of course, I'm sure that in Sinhalese, you say mangala, there must be some sort of similar word there somewhere. Is there? Sorry? Oh, yeah, Jayamangalam, yeah. Jaya means more like a victorious. But anyway, so Mangala is just a word which is used everywhere. So I wonder, what is Mangala? What is auspicious? What is a blessing? What has real meaning in people's lives? And so because of that, the Buddha taught, as the Buddha's taught, the Maha Mangala Sutta, the greatest good fortune. Fortune is maybe not the nice word, but it means fortune, meaningful, auspicious, no good thing to do, and beneficial to the world. And the nice thing about this sutta, that very often when I teach sutras, I like to teach the high-flying deep sutras about jhanas and anatta and the non-self and all that stuff, which people like. But this is really down-to-earth stuff to begin with. And it builds up and builds up as we go through these different verses. Some very refined teachings. And even though that I've been a monk for 47 years, that still even the first part of these is incredibly powerful and meaningful. So the first verse of the 10 verses of the Mahamangala Sutta begins with, not to associate with fools, but to associate with the wise, and to honor those worthy of honor. This is the greatest good fortune. And that is something which I often quote when people are maybe they've had some difficulties with drugs, difficulties with depression, getting stressed out. Now, how can we deal with such difficulties in life, which are sometimes have a huge amount of input from your social places which you visit? And they say one of the greatest things to do is to associate with good people, hang out with good people, and to avoid sort of people who, you know, obviously not as virtuous and kind and generous as the people who come here. To associate with good people is a great blessing. And that's one of the reasons why when a person, of course you deal with this often, you know, kids who get addicted to drugs, and they really want to get off those drugs, and they can have medication, they can do mindfulness and other types of meditation, and they really want to sort of change their life around. But of course, one of the most difficult things for them is, yeah, they may go overseas, they may go to some therapy center, they may have all sorts of great advice, but when they go home, if they associate with their old friends, the bad people again, and they soon get sucked back into just the old terrible ways of behavior. So that's one of the reasons why associating with good people has a huge impact on people. And even just, not just good people, but good places as well. I don't know how many people, they go to places like Dhammasara Nuns Monastery or Bodhinyana Monastery, are just looking for the way out. Is that, are all the doors locked? Oh, all open, oh good. That's why we're the Buddhist society, so we must always say the doors of our hall are always open to you, to come in and go out. So, to be able to even places, if you can stay in a good place, it has a huge effect on a person. And that's one of the reasons why that sometimes people come here. I'm just coughing. Yeah, I think it's okay. No, he's fine. Going back in now. So, to be able to stay with places where there are good people, you somehow pick up on the energy of that. So many times that people come and say to go to Dhammasara, go to Bodhinyana, Jhana Grove, all these other places, and they just like going there, associating with good people. And it attracts other good people. There's a kind energy there. And that just by itself is very powerful therapy. And still, I remember that story of the building surveyor of Serpentine Gerardel. And I must have seen him many times in the office, but only once saw him in Bodhinyana Monastery. When he came up to the hall after the lunch, and said, I just want to come up here to thank you. I said, thank me? I've got to thank you for approving all of our buildings. He said, no, it's nothing to do with that. He said, whenever you got stressed out at work in the offices of Serpentine Jarrodell Shire, which was over in Muntijong, whenever I got stressed out at work, I'd just get in my car and come to your car park. And I'd just sit there in the car park for half an hour. And that's all I needed. And after half an hour in your car park, I went back to work without any stress. So thank you for your car park, he said, Ajahn. And that already quite surprised me. But you understand that those people of you who've gone to Dhammasara or Bodhinyana or this place, just be able to sit here and just get some of the peaceful energy, which people say. That's associating with good people who made these good places. And it is a really powerful blessing. It feels much better. This other gentleman, I can't really say his name because he's now a famous businessman, but he had trouble with drugs, with heroin over in, what was it, cocaine? But you know, one of the heavy drugs, over in Singapore. I mean, they really take that serious over there. You get whipped or you get executed. And so his dad was very smart and sent him over to Bodhinyana Monastery many years ago for 2 or 3 weeks. And that changed his whole life. 2 or 3 weeks. He always says, thank you, thank you, thank you. If I hadn't gone there for that 2 or 3 weeks, I don't know what might have happened to him. Now he's married with a good family and doing really well in business. So, and every now and again he sends a check over here. Say thank you. Big one. But anyway, just associating with good people is a great blessing. So, you know, if someone has terrible, terrible, terrible time, just to stay with kind, good people in a kind, good place has a huge benefit. And the same with not to associate with fools. Fools means those people who don't really understand just how to be happy, how to have a good time, how to be joyful, how to be forgiving. Sometimes we say, well, that's what everyone else does. You know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and it might feel that way if you live with dogs. But if you live with good people, you feel that that's not the way to go. So association with good people and avoiding foolish people and places where foolish people congregate is a marvelous blessing. Have you been to the casino? I almost got into the casino once in Perth. I was going for another event and it was a Burswood ballroom. I'd never been to Burswood before, I didn't know which way to go. I went with Sol, who was taking me to this event. We didn't know where to go, we parked a car and went through a doorway. We were just walking, don't know where the heck we were going. We passed this entranceway and it's full of lights and noise and sound. And I turned to look and I thought, oh my goodness, that's the casino. If someone sees me in here, I'm dead. You may get a picture of me. So quickly I turned around, come, let's get out of here quick. And that's the closest I've got to the casino. But sometimes you can feel there's really bad energy there. I don't know what you feel, but anyway, that's what I feel. Just get out as soon as you can. So you try and avoid those places if you possibly can, because sometimes you just get sucked into other people's bad energy. And also to honor those worthy of honor. Which means when you pay respect and honor people means actually holding them high. That's one of the reasons why we bow to the Buddha. Because what the Buddha stands for is something which is very important to respect. That's why you bow to myself and Venerable Ananda if we're here, or the nuns. There's something about being a monk which is very worthy of respect. And that's, of course, what you bow to. And they said to honor those worthy of honor is an important thing to be able to do. It's not some just old tradition which is just way past its use-by date. Because these days, how many people in our community do you honor and trust? In the old days, we'd always respect the policeman, we'd respect teachers, we'd respect, I think doctors are still okay. Where's Mukta? Are they? But sometimes even some of the doctors, the senior doctors, are they really worthy of respect and honor? So it's sad when all these people are politicians, that we don't respect them anymore, and just we get what we have. If it really is a respectable tradition, it's usually people trying their best to live up to that position of honor. But when you do find people of honor, people you can respect, please respect them. A thing I told the other day just to people in the car, that one of the monks, a long time ago, when he was a monk, he's sitting over there, he disrobed some years ago because of ill health. I think it was the gentleman over there. That he was, he went to the hospital for some time, couple of weeks. And afterwards he said, no, they really looked after him when he was in hospital. I said, why don't you say thank you? I said, to whom? Well, why not write to the Minister of Health? I forget who it was at the time. So he wrote a letter to the Minister of Health and saying, thank you for looking after me so well. And he meant it, how these politicians, how busy they are. But then he showed me, he got a letter back, a personal letter from the Minister of Health, not one written by the secretary, you know, scribbled out in his own handwriting, saying thank you. It's so rare to get a letter like this to praise him. Thank you so much. And so you can see, just to be able to somehow find ways of praising those, honoring those worthy of honor, is a beautiful thing to do. It is inspiring. And of course, every time when they have this John Curtin Medal ceremony, they didn't have one last year, or they did have one, but it was in the evening because they didn't want too many people associating together because of COVID. I love going to that ceremony. I got that medal once, and I realized how beautiful it is, you know, to be honored and also to honor those others who are worthy of honor. And see just how many amazing beings there are in this community called Perth, doing wonderful things, sacrificing so much, and really just putting their life on the line sometimes, or reputation on the line, because they know that something really needs to be done, and they do it. And when I go there and honor those worthy of honor, I get inspired to improve my game as well. So if I can do a bit better, and to honor those worthy of honor and take their example to give me inspiration to keep on working to make sure we can make a better world. So that's half an hour gone, and that's the first verse. Oh, you got a question? Go on. Yeah. Yes. Yes. The prologue says that many devas and humans ask this question. So what is your take on this? So as the devas and the humans, most devas must have been very close to the human realm. They wanted to know what's a good thing to do. Because, you know, they could have access to good teachers. But of course, what we have here, the reason why it became very popular is because it really is inspiring teaching of like Buddhism or any religion on how we should behave. But again, even for devas, I know that some people kept on telling me, they said, oh, the once you're a deva, you're just bliss, you know, having fun and happiness all the time, you can't make any progress on the path. And of course you can make progress on the path. And so many times that devas would listen to people giving teachings and they would get inspired, and sometimes something would click for them. And there's very powerful, deep teachings, some of them would listen, and that'd be enough to actually to get improved stages of enlightenment. So even in the deva realm, some people just got progress on their path towards full enlightenment. I can understand how that works. So this is for the devas, but also for humans as well. Okay, verse 2. To live in a suitable place, having done good karma in the past, and to apply oneself in the right way, is a great good fortune. And it's easy to say that here because, you know, you've got to be fair and just say Perth is a very fortunate place. You know, we do have, you know, there is some multiracial harmony, basically. And there's some places where people just have racism, or they are gender discriminatory, or but the most people are just really fair-minded and kind and good. It's only a very small minority. They can create a lot of problems, of course, but most people are just really fair-minded and kind. It's not a bad place to live, you know, here in Perth. And you can walk, I can walk the streets of night. I don't do that, by the way. But if I feel safe here in this city, in this town. I don't know about you. And people are usually kind enough and well-being enough that they won't harm you. So it is a suitable place. Lots of space in Perth. You can get a nice place to live. And of course, there's very good monasteries here in the place you're here living. And it's, you can, you feel having kids, your kids are safe. You can come to monasteries, and they go to universities, and they can do well in life. There's enough money to get by, but it's not one of those big capital cities which are the focus of, you know, criminal gangs or something. So it's a beautiful city, and there's lots of space and good air, and of course, you know, no COVID, very little COVID. And having done good karma in the past, now this is personal, you know, that sometimes people don't realize just how much good karma they have done in the past. Because as I was saying last night in the story of the two bad bricks and the wall, the nature of human beings is always to focus on the bad stuff we've done, the faults in life. You know, we have this, you make sort of a beautiful job of cleaning the windows of this hall, and most of the windows are clean. We can see one or two small parts which haven't been cleaned. And that's where you get annoyed at and you focus on, instead of seeing the majority of the windows are clean. Well done. Why do we always look at the faults and want to fix up the faults? And that's one of the reasons why we don't realize how much good karma we have done in the past. And as I was saying last night, we were still looking for people to help out with the audiovisual team, to be able to share these teachings much further than just Perth to the whole world. And as the way I understand it, that's incredibly huge good karma. It's amazing. Just if you help out doing stuff like that, because the Buddha said the greatest gift is the gift of Dhamma. Yeah, I can teach it, but it doesn't get outside these walls. If we didn't have the people in that little room recording it and sharing it on the internet throughout the whole world. And so people at any time, they can listen to it, re-listen to it, re-listen to it, until it has a marvelous effect. I only wish there was an AV team in the time of the Buddha, so we could have recordings of what the Buddha actually said. Oh, but what you're doing now is amazing. So that good karma and supporting those people who are teaching the Dhamma, teaching some Dhamma yourself. It's amazing what we're actually doing here. And obviously, you know me, that one of the things which I always really get inspired by is the fact that we've reinstituted the bhikkhuni tradition here in Perth. That is huge. Some of you don't realize just how powerful that was. That being part of that, getting involved in that. Wow, that's history making. That'll go down in books in the future. So those good karma, I love remembering those amazing acts of good karma. You've done good karma, respect, remember it. And then you are just like worshipping what's worthy of worship, honoring that which is worthy of honor, your goodness, your good karma. And that just gives you huge amounts of energy. Forget your faults. Just focus on the good stuff you've done. And then, whoa, you get so blissed out, and it's beautiful energy, pure energy. And to apply oneself in the right way. Go on. That's one of the ways of applying oneself, remembering the goodness in this world. overcoming that fault-finding mind, which always sees, you know, what's wrong. You said something wrong, you did something wrong, but you also did something right as well, something inspiring, something kind. The amount of selflessness which I see in this place and in Bodhinyana monasteries is incredible. People just want to help, they want to be kind, they want to give, they want to find out little things like, you know, what the monks want to eat in the morning. And they come out and they try extra hard to make sure it happens. That's just really just, it's not just greed. It's just, I get really inspired by that, how much you give. This evening, when I get back to Bodhinyana Monastery, you know what I do after the tea time, talk with the monks. And from 7:15 to usually about 8:30 or something, some monks come up to my room to give me a foot massage. Honestly, please don't repeat this to the monks, I don't need a foot massage. And sometimes I go back, I'm tired, I just want to be by myself and meditate. Honestly, I think like that sometimes, actually most times. But no, because these monks are trying to be kind to me, do something which is a service. And so, yeah, please come up and do that. And the word got around. I remember going off to some retreat over in Yogyakarta, and it's the Buddhist Fellowship, the Singaporeans were organizing it, and they heard that I had foot massages every now and again. So they asked me, so I just arrived in the hotel offered foot massages. Do you want a foot massage? I said, no, not really. I said, it's already been booked. I had no choice. And so they got this expert give me a foot massage. And honestly, it was nowhere near as good as the ones given by monks who have never actually done foot massage before in their life. Why was it much better when it came from fellow monks? Because they were just doing it out of kindness, out of goodness, of service. And that's what I understand, that's actually how to apply oneself in the right way. Some of these things you don't need to be an expert. Just your kindness is what really works. And my kindness, and it, I'm not over-exaggerating, my kindness to offer my feet on a Sunday evening to be massaged. Okay, it's not my feet anyway, it's yours. We have a lot of fun. What they really try to do though, you know, you've heard this, they try and really massage me really well and then just get me very soft and malleable. And then when I'm really, you know, half falling asleep and very good mood, then they say, Ajahn Brahm, is it okay if I get this? That's when they ask all of the privileges, which I wouldn't usually say yes to. Well, okay. Anyway, let's keep going, otherwise we're not finished. Apply myself in the right way. Live in a suitable place, having done good karma in the past. Oh. And to apply oneself in the right way, that is auspicious. You've done that. Well done. To be educated and have a good vocation. The word is bahusachancha, having learned a lot. We're not, you know, into people being stupid. But you know, there are some people who just, they don't do well at universities. But that doesn't mean that they are not well educated. As you know, there's many, many people who left school or university early. It's because they just had a lot of time dyslexia, or they had other problems. But they're just so wise in life. I know there's one person, one of the wisest people I ever met. He only did 4 years at school. His name was Ajahn Chah. So he was learned. But you couldn't say well-educated, but was just very, very wonderful. And have a vocation. Having a vocation is just when you find something in your life, and it's great if this happens to you, and you know this is what you always really wanted to do. It's your work is, you know, not really just to get money, but it's a vocation. You love doing that. You feel comfortable in life doing that. And of course, you know, as I put my hand up, as soon as I found out being a monk was a vocation and got into it, wow! I'd never look back from that. That's, you know, it's who you are. And so imagine that you've got a job a vocation, a position in life, and you're so comfortable doing that. And it's just, I never ever want to do anything else in my whole life except be a monk. And so if you have that, if it's even just like a train driver or a secretary or an accountant or a teacher at a school or whatever your life is, a water engineer, if you really like that, you really think, I know about this and I can serve and help lots and lots of people. Wow. Isn't it great when you have a vocation and you understand what it really means and how it helps others and you can commit yourself to that? Oh, beautiful. It doesn't mean you want to sort of get up on in your career. You know, there's no career advancement for me. You're a monk and that's it. You don't get sort of rises. I don't get any pay rises. I don't get any. What else do you can get? The only thing you do get a, I haven't got it. I do get a cushion sometimes in the back. That's the only acknowledgement you've been a monk for a while. But anyway, it's a vocation which you love. And to be well trained in one's chosen field. Ah, that's also amazing. That's your vocation, this is your field. And you really get into it and you really learn it. So you're not just doing the vocation, become an expert each in your own little ways and on how to deal with water and how to get sort of for engineering or what else do some of you do. Just how you can make Italian soup and you get very, very good in that field. You really put your energy and effort into it. And that means that you really get learned in that field. And these are places where if you do that, it means your vocation is just you put that little bit extra in there because you love doing that. So as a monk, there's all these other little things you can do, you can learn, and you try your very best to do your best for everybody. So you're well trained in your chosen field and to speak words that are well spoken. You know that people sometimes speak so much rubbish. You know that. Unkind words. And I just can't get my head around that. Why people say cruel words which are nasty to each other? Why they cause hurt? If someone's done something wrong, they know what they've done wrong. They all do. It's one of the things I discovered when I went to prison to teach prisoners. I never, ever found any prisoner, even some really bad prisoners, hard prisoners, never found anybody who didn't feel guilty about what they'd done. They regretted it. But they could only say that in private to you, because they didn't want to admit to their friends, you've got to be tough in a jail. So we all know when we've done wrong things, and to speak bad words, you regret it. And that's one of the reasons why if ever you say a bad word to your partner in life, say sorry straight away. Say something nice. Because if you say a bad word, there's always competition in married life. Someone says a bad word and your partner has to say something worse, and then you say something even worse. Or you give as good as you got. It's like a fight in a boxing ring. And so instead of that, just stop that and just cease for a while, and then just say something nice, something which you would like to hear. And that's part of right speech, you know, for the Eightfold Path, to speak words which are soft to the ear, which are kind, which are gentle, which people love to hear. And if you do things like that, that people will only speak kind words back to you. What was that one story? There was one of the toughest monks, Westerner, in our tradition. He probably was the toughest of all the monks because he was in the Vietnam War. He volunteered to join the US Marines. And the reason he did that was to get tougher. His name was Ananda, but not this Ananda. And he was he was shot in the back of the head in Vietnam. And he was, that got him out of the army, knocked some sense into him. But he was a very tough guy. I mean, he became a monk. But then this one day, that we were doing some chanting, And usually the chanting, like the Mahamangala Sutta, we chant it like a monotone. Asewana Chabala Nang Pandita Nancha Sewana. We're not supposed to make it musical. There's one chant, there's only one little chant, which is supposed to be introduction to devas, to try and invite devas to come and listen to these chants. And that was allowed to be musical in some traditions. Usually it wasn't. Pravitawana metang sameta badanta, it started off with. But some people make it very beautiful. Paritawa sameta badanta. I'm getting old, so I can't chant that well as usual. But this young man, Ananda, he's about 4 years as a monk, he chanted it musically, and it was gorgeous. He really put a lot of energy and effort into it, make it sonorous. Then all the other monks said, that's not how you're supposed to do it. It's supposed to be monotone. Don't do that ever again. They told him off. And I could see from his face that he was just so disappointed and frustrated, put so much time and effort into learning it, making it nice. And it was rejected. I think it was only maybe just a young monk, maybe 1 year or less as a monk. And on the way out, you could see him really depressed. And I spoke into his ears. Venerable Ananda, if I was a heavenly being, I would have come. That was beautiful. And from that one kind word, he was my friend for life. From that time on, he would always protect me, look after me, care for me, become a really nice friend. Just one kind word was all it took when he really needed somebody to look at life in a different way. And that meant a lot to me because he's a very, very good friend and always very, very nice to me. So like good words, their power is immense. Bad words, they just make life black and awful and dull and angry. So speak words that are well spoken. Of course, speaking words of the Dhamma is most well spoken. Now today, there's another reason why I'm happy to do this talk today, because today is, what special day is it today? It's not just Mother's Day, it's also Sunday. We don't have Daughter Day, it's really unfair. But anyway, it's Mother's Day. To support one's mother and father, to cherish one's partner and children, and have a peaceful occupation is the greatest good fortune. And even like monks, we support our parents. One of the monks just left a couple of days ago to look after his stay with his parents for a few days. And can't say no to that. Especially if your parents are very, that was Sampa. If your parents are sort of sick and needy, of course you go and look after them. As monks even. So you know, we look after our parents. And so I looked after my mother. I told the story of all the, I got too many stories, I'm going to be quiet. You know, but you know, of the taking this kangaroo, stuffed toy kangaroo and koala and kookaburra and wombat. Cherry knows all about that. She got them for me, I think. To take to my mother, remind her of her son in Australia, nice soft toys. And that's looking after my mum. But she put them all on the same shelf, and when she got the wombat, everything else started falling off. And I just could not convince her to throw some things away or give it to some charity, share it out with somebody else. No, they're really important. When you keep too many important things, you've got no room to appreciate them. And I said, why don't you give those other ones away? Find a nice home for them, put the wombat in there. And then that will be on its own on your shelf, and you can really mean something. It's not sort of disturbed by all the other animals on there. And that's one of the reasons why even just going to help your mum, you always get a Dharma story there somewhere. But anyway, helping your mother and father, just like your mother and father helped you, when you think of all the stuff which your parents did for you, oh, it's really so immense. Their sacrifice. I know it's Mother's Day, not Father's Day today, but as a kid I still remember when I got a place in the school soccer team. I was only 11 years of age. And I was so proud. I was playing for the school and the soccer team. And I asked my dad, can you come and watch me? He said, I can't, I'm working. He was working on Saturday morning when I was playing soccer. And I remember that. I felt so disappointed. The first match and your dad wasn't there to watch you. And you can imagine what it felt like. The game had already started. And then I heard someone shout out at me, hey, that sounds like my dad's voice. And I turned around, it was him. And imagine the uplift you got. You know, that someone who shouldn't have been there managed to get away to get there. And I asked him after the match, how did you get here? He said, I told my boss at work that every Saturday morning for the next 7 or 8 weeks, I've got to have this series of injections from my doctor. he was not an honest man, I must admit, but he was always kind. And if he got caught, he probably got sacked. But he did that because to him, it was more important that he saw his son play soccer. Ooh, sado, dad. So they support you, you support them, best you possibly can, to cherish one's partner and children. How easy it is to cherish your children. The children, you don't know who they are, where they come from. They just come out of your wife's womb and you're stuck with them for life. You can't get divorced from your children. You can't take them to the children's shop and have a swap. They're yours forever. You don't know who they are, but you love them unconditionally. Why can't you love your partner unconditionally too? Some people do. But some people, they have far more demanding criteria to live up to with their partner. Children, that's my kid, you'll always love them. Why can't husbands and wives love each other like you love your children? Interesting. But anyway, but Buddha says to cherish one's partner and children and to have a peaceful occupation. It's quite hard to get peaceful occupations these days, especially when you want to sort of make a lot of money in this world. Oh, sometimes even the office is so noisy. But there are sometimes some occupations you may, if you're very lucky, and it's a great blessing, it is peaceful. And think, being a monk, is that peaceful? Think, oh, you must be so lucky being a monk. You go back to Bodhidharma Monastery, it's so peaceful there. Sometimes. You don't know what's happening next. There are all sorts of interesting things happening, just like any other place in the world. I think I told this over in Bodhidharma Monastery, when the SWAT team came to Bodhidharma Monastery, the Tactical Response Group. The TRG, have you seen the TRG before? Because what happened? Nice peaceful monastery. But then next door, there was the most wanted man in Australia, not just West Australia, wanted man in Australia, was camping out. And that piece of land next to the Telstra Tower. And the head of the Peel Police Detective Force, whatever they call it, came and saw me. He wanted to speak to me. He said, look, the most wanted man is up in that, is your neighbor right now. We've located him. He's really dangerous. He has arms. You know, he's got guns and I don't know what else. And we're going to go in to arrest him. And he said, you know, we have to bring in the tactical response group with their weapons. The reason we've come to ask you is you've got this wonderful wall in the front of your monastery. Can we use that as our staging post? Because we can get our cars and trucks in there without anybody really seeing it. And that's where we will, you know, have, you know, the emergency response team, you know, with doctors and cases of firefight or something. And we're going to go in there. I can't tell you, he said, when, but it will be in the next week. Can you please tell your monks, just if they hear anything strange, any strange noises, please go into your huts, close your windows, and don't come out, because it's dangerous. Might be a gun battle. And so I had this meeting with the monks, called a special meeting and I said, look, something's going to happen in the next few days. I can't tell you what, but if it happens, please stay in your rooms. And they said, you've got to tell us. I said, I can't. We're monks, you must. Ajahn Brahmani was there, and so he remembered it with a laugh. And you know, they respected me in the end, and they said, okay, well, if something happens, we'll stay in our rooms. And 2 days later, of course, it happened, because I had all of the helicopters swooping down low, you know, quite a few of them. And you couldn't really miss the noise. And when they started swooping in low, you know, of course, monks are supposed to be well behaved, but one of them wasn't. And I caught him and sent him back into his hut. He said, why? I've got to find out what's going on. Human nature, but anyway, sort of they stayed in. And it worked out okay. It was very lucky, because this tactical response group, they were actually waiting in the bushes. And that's when this most wanted man in Australia, he came out just to take a wee. And they literally caught him with his pants down. Literally. And so he couldn't fire anything. And afterwards, when the head of detectives came to thank me for the sort of cooperation, he said, it's very good your monks stayed in their rooms, because this prisoner had a bald head. So what do you think the helicopters would have seen from up there? There's a fellow over there, there he is. So to live in a peaceful environment, it's usually peaceful, is a wonderful blessing. Have a peaceful occupation. And generosity and righteous conduct, kindness towards one's relations, and the doing of blameless deeds. Oh, this is actually what you do. And generosity, I told this story at lunchtime. Even monks can be generous. So, I don't mind blaming, not really blaming, but praising. This is our assistant treasurer, V. She, with one of her family members, I think it's a nephew, came to monastery a couple of days ago. And they were wondering what I had in my bowl after lunch. No, just right before lunch. So have a look. So I opened up the lid of my bowl and the little kid came, how old was he, about 4 or 5? Came up and had a look. And there was like a chocolate muffin in there. So he put his hand and picked it up and took it away. Honestly, I didn't mind. I thought it was so cute and funny. But then I had another chocolate. We swapped it and I got my muffin back. But like generosity, being kind. You can't say, no, you can't take that stuff from a monk's bowl. Of course you can. So, my fault anyway for opening my bowl for him. Anyway, so generosity and good conduct, righteous conduct, and kindness towards one's relations and everybody. What a wonderful blessing that is. So however in this world you can give kindness to the people who you're close to. And every act of kindness just means so much to you. It means so much to them. Okay. To refrain from what is kind and the doing of blameless deeds. So often we say that, if I did this deed, this act, how would other people think? But not just other people, the wise people. What would Ajahn Chah say? What would my friends in the holy life say if I did this deed? A lot of times it makes it very easy to make ethical decisions. But you find out no matter what you do, there's always some blame in there somewhere. So you try and do your very best, the least blame, and where people can understand what you're doing or why you're doing it, and you do the best you possibly can. To be able to do that, what a great blessing that is in life. Any questions before I carry on? Good. Six, to refrain from what is unwholesome, to abstain from intoxicants. This is what you stop doing, the restraint. So intoxicants, I can never find a purpose when I was younger, taking alcohol or even drugs. This, what do you want to be unmindful for? There's too much to be gained by being fully aware. And the intoxicant, you see what other people do with intoxicants. You don't want to be like that. And to practice good qualities without delay. That's, I think this, I forget who did this translation, but without delay is a very nice little addition I've never seen before. Practice good qualities. Apamado chitamesa. Without delay means that sometimes that we can put off things until tomorrow. I'll do it tomorrow. Really good qualities. You should try and do as much as you can today. That's one of the reasons why people would always ask me, being a meditation teacher, when is the best time to meditate? When is the worst time to meditate? You all know the answer to that question. The best time to meditate is now. The worst time to meditate is later. In other words, do it as soon as you can. And respect and humility, contentment and gratitude, and a timely hearing of Dhamma. This is a great good fortune. Now we're getting into powerful stuff. Respect. You respect for people who are different than you. Respect to Christians and Muslims and non-believers and LGBTQIA+. Respect to people who are sick. Respect to people who may be loud when you want to be quiet. Sometimes respect for others because sometimes they can't do anything else. And that idea of respect and that caring for others is a powerful teaching. Whenever I meet people from different religions, I always try to make that respect. I don't agree with some of your ideas and interpretations of life, but I respect you, the human being inside of you. And how many times have you not been respected? How does it feel when people just look at you and say, oh, just, why don't you get a proper job, Ajahn Brahm? Well, you've been living off other people like some parasite for years. Why can't you dress in proper clothes instead of like... No, to give respect to people, they're trying their... I do have that confidence that human beings are trying their very best. Give them a bit more encouragement and they'd always do better. I respect humans. The human realm is a very high realm in Buddhism. It's a realm where the Buddha lived. And when he respected, even people sent to assassinate him, they couldn't hurt him at all. And they became stream winners. It's powerful. And humility. You don't have to always be the big shot. And I try my very best in that. You know, I am well known in this world, senior monk, author of many books. But I always try my best. Please, you don't have to open the door for me. I'm grown up now. I can open the door myself, you know. Thank you for making me a cup of tea, but you know, I can make a cup of tea myself. I learned that when I was a Boy Scout. I got my making cup of tea badge. But you know, it's nice to be served, but also, please, never put any teacher in that higher place that it spoils them. You've got to encourage humility in everybody. Otherwise, people just can look at the fact that people are listening to them for over an hour and they can think there's something special with them. Nothing special with me. It's just special with the teachings, not the person. And that's also why I've said this many times. In Buddhism, we go to a refuge to the Triple Gem, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. This is not an Ajahn Chah tradition. It's not a forest monastery tradition. This is not, and certainly never going to be an Ajahn Brahm tradition or an Ajahn Chah tradition. We take refuge in the Sangha. Huge monks and nuns, never in one particular individual. And that's very beautiful. You may have a teacher, but your major teacher is the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. So that keeps the monks and the nuns just in the right place, not too proud of themselves. And contentment and gratitude. Why do they have those two words together? Because when you have gratitude, and when I go back this evening, tomorrow, look at Bodhinyana Monastery, there's so much work to be done there. That makes me discontent to think of that. But instead, I'm grateful for all the work which has been done. I look at this, my cave is clean enough, enough leaves have been swept, there are a few cracks in the walls, but the rest of the walls aren't cracked at all. So that makes the gratitude is one of the causes for contentment. You're grateful for your parents, you're grateful for your wife, your husband, your kids. They may not be the best, but they're good enough. Am I going on too long? Yeah. Is that okay? Okay, so grateful leads to contentment. And show that gratitude every now and again. Like I say, that monk who just was grateful to the health system and wrote to the health officer, the Minister of Health, and got a nice reply. Weird when you do things like that. And because people like to be appreciated, you show gratitude, and it makes the person do better even than they did before. And the timely hearing of the Dhamma has to be timely, the right time. One of the problems here is that sometimes people can't get to the temple on a Friday or a Saturday or a Sunday when the talk is being given. Isn't it wonderful? Now it's all recorded, so you can hear it anywhere. And you can hear it in bed if you're sick. You can even hear it in the toilet. Honestly, I don't mind. You can hear any of my talks on the toilet because at least you're hearing them. Anywhere will do. But if you do hear the talks in bed, you know, so many people do that before they go to sleep at night. They just put in one of the talks and listen to it on their iPhone or something. And that's one of the reasons why that woman over in Berkeley, she was introducing me a couple of years ago when I gave a talk at a conference there. So I'd like to introduce Ajahn Brahm. I know him very well. I go to bed with him every night. And that's what she said. I cracked up laughing because I knew what she meant, and she explained it. Look, I just listen to one of his talks every night. So I said, I go to bed with him, but just the talks, not him. So I'm a good monk. And the timely hearing of the Dhamma. So please hear it when it's useful for you to hear, when it's needed. And being patient and easy to correct. It's amazing how impatient people are. They want things to be done really quickly. They want to be enlightened straight away. They want this talk to finish because it's almost 4:15. Be patient. And that patience is like a softness. It's one of the most important parts of meditation as well, to develop that patience. So you can just allow things to happen rather than make things happen. And there we go. Being patient, easy to correct. Easy to correct. You do something wrong, say something wrong, and just get some advice from others. But a lot of times, some of my monks, even Ananda here, says, oh, please, if I did anything wrong, let me know. But then he doesn't do much wrong at all, and it's much more important we find out for ourselves. If you do anything really, 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 really wrong, of course I'll let you know. But most of the time, monks are very good. And some of you say, oh, if I'm doing anything wrong, Ajahn Brahm, please let me know. And I've got to scratch my head. What have you done wrong? You haven't done anything wrong. You're good enough. The seeing of monks and nuns. Now that is, you think that's an ordinary thing, but that's a big thing. It's one of the reasons when I was a young layperson, student, I became a Buddhist at 16 by reading books. Before my father died, it wasn't as a result of it. Reading books, and then afterwards, what do I do next? And I never realized there was a Sri Lankan temple just in the next suburb, about a mile away from where I lived. And even that area, I'd have parties there, girlfriends down there, my friends were down there, and I never saw them. And it's because I found out afterwards, whenever they went anywhere, they'd go in a car, go to the destination, go into the person's house, go back into the car, and then go back to the temple. You never see them walking along the streets. And when I found that out, I thought, if I'd have seen those Sri Lankan monks walking down the streets, oh, that would have been so important to me. And I'd have gone to their temple straight away. But I didn't know they existed because I didn't see them. So when I got to Thailand and Ajahn Chah said, go out, walk down the streets, let people see you. And I understood that straight away. Even just the sight of a monk, the sight of a nun is really, really important. So you know, every Saturday morning we go on an alms round. You know, I tell the monks, if you're going in to get something from Bunnings, walk and talk to people. Get out as much as you can, because that's a wonderful way of letting people see that monks and nuns actually exist. And it's a great way of spreading the Dhamma. That's why we had alms rounds for. And the timely discussion of the Dhamma is the great Buddha's fortune. So you have the hearing of the Dhamma and discussing it. It's not just listening, it's asking questions, which is a good point just to ask any questions. Yeah. Yes. You know, who's teaching a meditation retreat this weekend at Jhana Grove? The nuns! We're getting there. Okay, it takes a bit of a while, but we're getting there. And oh, that's right, yeah. Yeah. So we're getting there. So just little by little, try and have more of that. You see, now there's that equity there. This is great. It's good for me as well, because you know I'm getting old now, so I've got to start thinking about succession planning. But to get sort of these great nuns, great monks to take over. And number nine, practicing the higher precepts and meditation. That is, the higher precepts is more like restraint, simplicity, not doing so much in your life. Those higher precepts and doing the meditation. Here's brahmachari anshan. What that really does mean is like sexual restraint, sensual restraint. So you don't sort of indulge so much in this world. Because sense restraint is part of the way of giving your mindfulness power. Instead of waiting, you know, allowing your mindfulness to get sort of really excited by seeing beautiful people or wonderful music or exciting events, we calm things down. And when you practice sense restraint, which is what we're supposed to be doing on meditation retreats, wow, you find your meditation really deepens. You're not so excited. You don't need to be stimulated so much because you're peaceful and calm. And practicing the higher precepts of meditation, insights into the noble truths. Now you're getting into the big time. Getting insights, understanding why. But it has to come after the meditation and after the sense restraint. That's where the insights come from, the understanding. So it's not from listening to monks like me or nuns like Ayahasapanya. It's actually from deep meditation, really understanding what's going on. And that's where we get our great insights into the noble truths and the seeing for oneself of Nibbana. Now, wow. You're really getting into something now. You understand just what we're here for. And it's not understanding by hearing it from somebody else. It's not because you studied it and understand the etymology of the Pali word nirvana and trying to work it out from that, but experiencing it for yourself. That's what the Buddha promised can be done. Practicing the path, sense retreat, mindfulness, stillness in meditation, otherwise known as Eightfold Path. That leads to the experience of Nibbana for yourself. So you don't have to trust anybody else. You know for yourself. But sometimes you've got to be careful, because if I did have time again, which I don't, tell that lovely story of my first, when I became enlightened. And in fact, you know that story. It's in one of my books. Some people have forgotten the story because they're looking at me with seriousness. It only lasted about 12 hours. At that time, maybe less, maybe about 8 hours. And then I thought I was enlightened, another enlightened being in the world. Oh, I felt so wonderful. I was just not messing around, just with great insights and amazing energy and power. And then just that day they had these two pots of curry. One was rotten fish curry, one was a pork curry. And the pork curry was really, really rare. I used to be a vegetarian before, but this was actually edible. And the rotten fish curry was raw. And the head monk, I thought this pork curry special. I thought maybe the heavenly beings, just like the Pepsi story, they were celebrating another enlightened being in the world. Yay! I'd have a good celebratory lunch that day. And of course, the head monk, he was a local boy. He took this two or three huge ladles, no one could eat that much, of the pork curry, put it into his bowl. And I thought that was really greedy. But then I thought, it's plenty left for me. What he did next. What that head monk did next was unforgivable. He took what was left of the pork curry, poured it into the rotten fish curry, and stirred it all up together, saying, it's all the same, it's all the same. And if it was all the same, why didn't you mix it up together first before you take yours? So I was really upset and angry. And then I remembered, enlightened beings aren't supposed to get angry. I realized I wasn't enlightened after all. Oh. And I also remember, just finishing that story, when you think you're enlightened, find out you're not. You don't care what you eat. I was so depressed, okay, bug it in. But actually experience what enlightenment is yourself. Whoa. Amazing. That was the greatest good fortune. Yeah? No. And the rotten fish curry was rotten. That's why they called it that. They keep this fish, they catch it during the rainy season retreat, and they just put it in a jar and it goes off. And they get used to that taste. They do, I don't. It stinks. Anyway, and the last thing, a mind that remains unshaken by the pork curries and rotten fish curries of the world. There you go. Oops. There we go. Oh, just get myself. A mind that remains unshaken by the ups and downs of the world. Sorrowless, stainless, and safe. This is the greatest good fortune. This is where, having realized Nibbana, it gives you an idea of what it's like. The mind's unshaken, which is, when you don't get what you want for food, and when your head monk sort of is a total hypocrite and greedy as well. If you really were enlightened, you wouldn't be shaken by that. So you get some cancer, it gets healed, friends die, somebody doesn't turn up, whatever, all those things in life, you don't get shaken by it. In other words, you're at peace. You don't get shaken by the ups and downs of the world, sorrowless, stainless, and the last word is interesting, and safe. Safe from all of the emotional turmoil of life, the pleasures and displeasures, the disappointments and elation. Safe from all of that, so you've got nothing to worry about ever again. Having performed these things, nowhere can they get conquered. They are secure wherever they go. This is the greatest good fortune. And that's the Mangala Sutta. I rushed it at the end because I've gone over time. I thought it'd be a nice, easy one. It's done very quick, an hour. Anyway, any questions? Oh my goodness, from overseas. What about the people from here, first of all? Questions? Yeah. Do what? That's not what you do, that's just what happens when a person becomes enlightened. By meditating. Look, a great story is for the Zen monk, Hokkien. And he was, you know, a nice, great monk in Japan a long time ago. And he was lived up in the mountains close to a village. The village would give him alms food. And then one day in the village, one of the women in the village, young women, got pregnant. And it was one of the village boys. They're having a little affair together. And you know, she couldn't hide it any longer that she was pregnant. And her father was really upset. I said, who did it? Who was it? And she didn't want to say the real culprit was her boyfriend. He didn't want to get him into trouble. So the girl said, oh, the monk. He's responsible. And so the villagers met together and they all decided to, didn't know what to do. They tell the monk off. So they all went up there all together to where the monk was staying in the mountains, and they scolded him and shouted at him, you're not a real monk, you're a bad monk, blah, 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 blah. And all he'd ever say was, arsehole. There was no L on the end, okay? Arsehole. And then when they told him off, and they thought, told him off enough, he wasn't shaken, he just carried on meditating afterwards. But when the kid was born, they said, well, you're the father, you look after it. So they brought this baby up to see them to the monk. I mean, imagine they did that, you know, to Ananda or to me. I don't know how to look after a kid. But, you know, you're responsible, you do it. So they gave this baby to this monk. And did the monk complain? They just said, also. Okay, never mind. And then after a while, sort of, you know, many of you have been mothers. And what do? You know, you miss your baby. You want your baby back. So after a few days, you know, she confessed that it wasn't the monk, it was this, my boyfriend, who's already fled, run away to the city. But, you know, I really feel really sorry. It wasn't the monk at all, it was my boyfriend. So all the people had another meeting. And all the lay people that went up to this monk again and said, oh, I'm terribly, terribly sorry. We shouldn't have criticized you like this. What did the monk do? Did the monk get a lawyer and get a defamation suit against these villagers? No, the monk just said, also. He wasn't shaken at all. Nothing he could do, so he just took on whatever he could do. And that's all. But he never felt humiliated, never felt mistreated, because that's part of life. I don't know how many times have you been humiliated, told off for things you didn't do, praised for things you didn't deserve. Of course, that's our life. It's just, so next time you get praised or told off, just say, ah, so. So when your family, say when you come home tonight, say, you're really back late from the center. What did you do that for? Ah, so. I suppose also the best translation is whatever. Okay, better get on to this one. From Vietnam, Dear Ajahn Brahm, how can we deal with constant criticisms that provoke tensions inside of us? I have tried to suppress by not talking back or reacting negatively, and it's happened for over a year. You're being criticised. Remember what Ajahn Chah taught me? I told it many times. If somebody calls you a dog, which is a terrible thing to criticise someone as, in a place like Vietnam, they call you a dog, you look at your bottom. See if you have a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. So if they're criticizing you constantly, is that criticism justified? Have you got a tail? Are you a dog? And if that criticism is justified, so say thank you. I didn't notice that before. I'll try to do something about it. But of course, most criticism isn't justified at all. You're not a dog. So you just let it come in, let it go out. I always say you open the door of your heart to whatever people say. Remember, the door has got two purposes: to come in and to let things out. So you listen to it, press it out. If it's not right, let it out again. And don't worry about it. Why do you worry about what other people say? What do they know about you? So the other people's criticisms, they're not usually valid. From Canada, what is meant by intoxicants in the suttas? Is it the tranquilizing drugs? No, it doesn't mean like sleeping tablets if they're said by your doctor. It doesn't mean you can't take tranquilizers before you have like a heart operation. Please take the anesthetics. There's another joke I heard the other day. This guy got a bill from an anesthetist after an operation. He said $900 for the anesthetist. He said, that's really expensive. Does it cost that much to knock me out? He said, no. We knocked you out for free. It's bringing you back round again. That cost $900. Interesting way of looking at it. Intoxicants in the sutta, it does mean things which take away your mindfulness and for no real reason. Of course, anesthetics before you have an operation do take away your mindfulness. When you're having that surgery, you don't feel a thing. But I would actually recommend that in that particular situation. It means in your ordinary life you don't take things like heroin, alcohol, marijuana, things like that. I have a question regarding right livelihood. I'm a student working part-time as a waiter, and I regularly serve alcohol to customers. Is this considered bad livelihood? If that's the only thing you do, just to serve alcohol or wine to your customers, then that would be, if you worked in a bar. But if it's just, I know many people who work in a bar, and they said it's not bad livelihood, they're called lawyers. Ha ha ha. Okay, that didn't go down well. Never mind. It's a joke, okay. Lawyers work at the bar. Okay, never mind. But if you regularly serve alcohol to customers, but that's not the main part of your job. The main part of the job is serving food. And of course, these days, if it is at a restaurant, then a lot of times that you only allow to serve a certain amount of alcohol, because you know, people go to a restaurant to eat, never to get drunk. So if that's the case, then that's fine. That's okay for not long livelihood. And I think your restaurant or wherever you work, they probably have a policy not to serve so much alcohol that the person just becomes irresponsible. Okay, any more questions from the floor? Great. So, it's time to go. So, hope you found that useful and interesting. And we're going to chart that on Sunday, Waisak Day, in 2 weeks' time. 2 weeks today is Waisak. And we're charting that house dharanas and very regularly the Mangala Sutta. So, hopefully, you found it useful. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami.
Anything from the other room?
No.
Yeah, if you want to go there, have you got all the stuff? You can go there first.